IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast supported by Pragati, a flagship media initiative of the Takshashila Institution. We're a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like to bring a fresh perspective to Indian affairs and an Indian perspective to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. I'm Atish Padi, Communications Manager at Takshashila and your host for today. With me is Arushi Kataria, Junior Research Scholar at Takshashila. And together we'll be discussing this remarkable book called Invisible Women by Caroline Peres, who is a British feminist journalist, author and activist. This book is an attempt by the author to show how much of our society has been designed keeping in mind men as a default, which results in women facing a lot of challenges in their everyday lives, in fact, which many of us might not be aware of. A lot of these challenges have to do with the fact that there is a lot of gender bias in the data that is collected for designing a lot of systems like transport or technology. Arushi will throw more light about the book and the author's arguments. So without further ado, we will get started. Hi, Arushi. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me. And yeah, to just get started, I also begin with what Peres begins her book with, a quote from Simone de Beauvoir, which says, "Representation of the world, like the world itself, is the work of men. They describe it from their point of view, which they confuse with the absolute truth." And this pretty much sums up Peres's argument throughout the book that the entirety of human history has often been written as the history of men. For instance, when we talk about hunters and gatherers, you thought of gatherers only when you realized that hunting was a job for men, but women existed too. So what did they do when you realized that they took part in something more communal like gathering? Or if you were to look at transit systems today, which we will also discuss, they're designed around the traveling habits of men, despite the fact that women make up more, you know, commuters than men do, especially during non-peak hours. And the fact that women tend to undertake so much unpaid care work and yet they aren't compensated for any of it. A very simple example of what, you know, Peres's entire argument is that when we fail to include the perspective of women whenever we're designing policies, whenever we're thinking about anything in the world, it's an unintended nail bite. She doesn't say that this is with, you know, malice or it's done because we are wantedly ignoring women. But the fact that for so long, all systems have been designed for men, that we forget that at the time these systems were designed, women probably didn't have access to all of these things, which is why data for them is not available. And simply because of the position that women have always, you know, had in society, measuring data for them was not seen as a very crucial task. And hence, even when we're trying to pass our policies as gender neutral by saying that, you know, we're actually taking into consideration everybody, one is probably just taking men into consideration. And I think that's what the entire idea of the book is, to tell us that how the policies that we look at, the very things we see around us, the systems, the models we see around us, have only ever accounted for men. Or under the rare circumstances that they believe to be gender neutral, they've only made a shallow attempt at wanting to include women, but really failing to see the realities of their lives and accounting for them in a manner that would really make a difference. And I think that's what Peres's entire argument throughout the book is, that we need to ensure that as we move forward, especially in a time where everything is being powered by technology, where we do have the means and the methods to collect data on women, especially if you're willing to do so, it is necessary to bridge this gender bias in collecting data so that our systems are, less biased towards women, and we create a more equitable world in the process of revamping all of the systems that currently exist in light of data that comes across on women.
Right. Thank you for that. That was an excellent starting argument. Now, let us zoom out a little bit and let's talk about something that we hear often, right, in terms of female employment in various sectors in the economy, right? A lot of argument is that women are not as employed as they should be. And India is one of the lowest female labor force participation rates in the world, right, alongside likes of Saudi Arabia. And a lot of people say that this is simply because women might be less, meritorious, or that they just do not want to take certain jobs, like jobs in technology, for example. And this is an argument that is even prevalent in the West, right? A few years ago, people like Jordan Peterson rose to fame by making arguments like this, saying that this is not some systematic bias, but simply that women are just not interested in areas such as technology or science as much as men, right? So what arguments does the book present to counter this view, which is quite popular, and we hear a lot of people, you know, resort to them while apologizing for low female participation in the economy?
Right. So I think something that, you know, a lot of the people who make arguments like Peterson have in common is that they stress the fact that, you know, people are playing up identity politics. But we have to remember that when it comes to these people who make such arguments, identity politics is only identity politics when it's about race or sex, that race and sex have nothing to do with wider issues like the economy. Like, as Peterson points out, that women just really don't want to work in tech, or they really don't want to work in, you know, a formal employed force. And they believe that it is narrow to specifically address the concerns of, say, female workers, female voters, or any voters of color. But really, is that really narrowing down anything? Because when we look at, say, the working class jobs in total, because, you know, these are the people who are a part of the workforce, men make up, say, in the US, they make up about 53,000 jobs, you know, according to data in 2016. But women make up almost 1 million jobs because of the fact that they undertake jobs like cleaning, housekeeping, working in nail salons. So when we're really saying that we want to account for women in the workforce, we aren't talking about a narrow number. We're talking about a number much greater than the men that are actually being employed. But as you mentioned, you know, meritocracy and, you know, why aren't people being employed? Now, Peterson's argument says that, you know, women just don't want to work in tech, or women just don't want to work in the formal workforce. But this goes beyond that. Most employment today is based on this idea of meritocracy. But meritocracy itself is a myth. And as Perez writes, it's a myth that provides cover to institutional white male bias. And it's a myth that is resistant to almost any sort of evidence that is being provided over the last few decades. It doesn't just go back a few years. And if we don't address the very issues why this meritocracy has come into play, we'll probably just end up with a workforce that looks a lot like the one we see today, that is comprised of men. Now, for instance, the people that are most likely to believe in this myth of meritocracy are people who come from academia, tech, and specifically the STEM workforce. Now, numerous studies have found around the world that, you know, female students in academics are significantly less likely than their comparable male candidates to receive funding, be granted meetings with professors, be offered mentoring, or even get a job. And this has nothing to do with them not wanting to get any of these opportunities. They really do. And a lot of this goes back to the bias that exists within this field. So within academia, since in the 21st century, men have self-cited 70% more than women. And women tend to cite other women more than men do. Meaning that the publication gap is a vicious circle. Fewer women are getting published because they don't get opportunities. This leads to them having a citation gap, which in turn further means, you know, that a metric of progress in academia is how many times have you been cited. And this means that they don't have the necessary prerequisite to then move forward. But academia doesn't realize that using citation as a metric itself is gender biased. Or, you know, if you were to look at something like research, when a person is researching, if they've crossed hurdles of getting funding, of being able to secure mentoring, etc., one is working with the assumption that they have the time to work in research. But as we must know, that women undertake 3 times more unpaid care work than men do. That at the end of the day, one was to really cumulatively put down how much care work a woman's doing. She has no time for leisure. So when women are doing all of this work, when there are no structural changes being made to ensure that they have time to work in the formal workforce, how do we really intend to get them into the workforce? That's another consideration. For instance, I think there was an article in The Guardian where an author says that, you know, he was appalled by the fact that a female coworker asked for a Friday off, given the fact that she had a child at home. And he said, I've had a child at home and I've never asked for a Friday off, forgetting that he has a wife who's taking care of the child, while his female co-worker probably doesn't have that kind of support system at home, and she's expected to look after this child. But more importantly, if we were to look at apparently the most unbiased, you know, professions of all, where you have extremely trained algorithms to select people, and this idea of, you know, whoever's more brilliant gets selected, we come up with tech. But tech itself is gender biased. For instance, you can train an algorithm to select the right people, but the kind of information you're providing it is important. For instance, if you look at Gill, which is, you know, a company, it's bought in-house for, it was bought over by another firm, but it's a tech hiring platform, which other companies have been using. It uses a person's frequency of visiting a manga site as a solid predictor of strong coding. But one must remember that having the time to go to a manga site is also a privilege, that women are less likely to engage in something like that. But to use that as a metric of hiring someone presents a gender bias. Or if you were to even look at the standard multiple choice aptitude tests that require little nuance, they've been found that this is the kind of math that you would expect men to be exposed to, but not women. Or the fact that within men, social networks exist because they have the time to build them and they're able to get hold of a lot of these questions beforehand, while women are biased against because they don't have these networks to begin with. They don't have the training that is a prerequisite to solve these questions of little nuance. So we have to consider that when we're not thinking of the ways in which women's lives differ from men, not just in what they do, but in what they study, how they are taught, and how they think, both in an online and offline mode, we are structurally biasing the world against women. We're ensuring that they don't have the gateway to enter the formal workforce, which relegates them back to the informal economy and to a life where they are back to doing unpaid care work. And when people like Peterson say that women don't want to work, that's really not the case. It's just that you don't see them working because the hurdles to them entering the workforce are so high.
Right. That was very passionate and excellent. Thank you for summing up so many brilliant points together. I wanted to add a couple of things, actually. So if listener, you are interested in understanding specifically in India why women's participation in the workforce is extremely low, I would recommend this brilliant book that came out late last year called Desperately Seeking Shah Rukh, which is not about Shah Rukh at all, by an amazing World Bank economist called Shayana Bhattacharya, and in which she shows how the experience of women in the Indian economy is so very different from that of Indian men. And she outlines many reasons. She talks to dozens of women across socioeconomic status, caste, class, and professions. She talks to all out of them. And Shah Rukh Khan comes in as the one common factor that all these women want to talk about. And through that, she talks about their experiences and draws out reasons why in India, women's participation in the labor force is extremely low. And one of the reasons that she identifies, which I found quite shocking and quite interesting, was that in India, a lot of people believed that as incomes rose after liberalization and families became wealthier, we should have more women entering the workforce because the opportunities for women, you know, getting higher education, etc., increases them getting skills required to enter the economy increases. But in fact, what has happened is that their participation has in fact decreased. And that is because as the income of households increased in India, what happened was a lot of families said that now women need not work and they can just stay at home because the men are earning more, right? Because in Indian families, it's a view that if a woman is working outside the house, that means that there's disrepute. It brings disrepute to the family. And that is one of the big reasons why very educated women from socioeconomic status, upper middle class, upper classes, do not work as much as one would expect. Work in the economy, of course, women do a lot of unpaid care work, as Arushi said. Then just finally, another point that I want to add was with relation to like workplace and how that also has a lot of gender bias. Is something very interesting that I read in a completely different book, which is nothing to do with this specifically, called The Transformative Constitution by Gautam Bhatia, who is a renowned jurist, legal scholar. Listener, you should like follow his blog. We will put it up in the show notes. He's absolutely brilliant. So Gautam Bhatia, in his book, in his first chapter, actually identified a case, which is very interesting, in which Delhi High Court was asked to rule upon whether a female inspector in the Central Reserve Police Force was worthy of promotion because she was denied promotion that she should have got according to her seniority, but she did not get it because it was cited that she had missed a pre-promotional course because of pregnancy. And according to the rules that were there, the regulations that decided who gets a promotion, who doesn't, not taking this pre-promotional course meant that she was ineligible to get promoted. Of course, the woman challenges this. And the Delhi High Court says that while the rule is seemingly neutral, it takes into account the fact that the baseline is a man, right? The woman that did not attend the course, not because she was unwilling to attend it, as the authorities put it, but because it was out of necessity. She had no other choice, right? And therefore the baseline for how these rules are formulated cannot continue to be met. And this judgment by the Delhi High Court, Gautam Bhatia argues, takes into account the transformative nature of the Indian Constitution, therefore the book's title, Transformative Constitution. And then he goes on to build many other arguments, goes into a lot of other cases about how even laws that are not outrightly discriminatory to women can also be extremely discriminatory if they believe that the baseline is that of a man. So yeah, two very good books that I think, listener, if you're interested in this topic more, you should check out. Now, really sorry for that monologue, Arushi. Now getting back to the book at hand, Invisible Women. My next question is, let's focus on a few specific examples and a few specific areas. You were talking about the transit sector, transportation, mobility, right? So now we know that, especially in India, and I'm constantly talking about India because my experience only has been in India, right? And I know women only from India. So in India, we know that transport, especially public transport, is an unsafe place for a lot of women. It's an unsafe space, and women are often anxious about that, right? So how does everything that you've said so far from the book, how does this bias, male bias, go into transportation system, and what are the effects of it?
Right. So I think the first example that, you know, I'd like to bring up from the book is this idea of hopping, or the fact that when women are taking trips, they tend to be accompanied by somebody who they need to drop off, they need to get some work done for them, which means that for them, it becomes really unuseful to constantly keep paying multiple fares. To sort of combat this is this idea of, you know, London had this thing called a hopper fare, where every time you change your transit system, you don't necessarily, wherever, every time you get off, say, from a bus, you don't necessarily need to pay if you get back on in, you know, stipulated times, which works because most of these tasks are going to be not very time consuming. They can drop off their child at school, get back onto the bus to the next destination, so on and so forth. Yet you have countries where this isn't really the norm. For instance, in Chicago, every time you change public transport, you have to pay. Now, what does this mean? Now, there was a study conducted in the US which compared Uber Pool with the public transport in Chicago, and it looked at trips downtown where most employment and the market exists. And they saw that the difference in time between Uber Pool and public transport was negligible. It was just about 6 minutes. But for trips between neighborhoods, that is, you know, the type of travel that women are more likely to undertake, given, you know, the responsibilities that they do have, Uber Pool took 28 minutes to complete all of those tasks, while public transportation took 47 minutes. And that is almost double the amount of time that, you know, a private way of doing things would take. But you also have to remember that the cost associated with Uber Pool is almost four times or three times that of public transport. So women either have to pay a much higher price to get done with work more efficiently, get their work done more efficiently, or they need to forego the time by spending double the amount of time in public transport systems. So that's the first idea, that if we've known for ages that women undertake chain methods of conducting their tasks, that they're more likely to hop between neighborhoods, it makes more sense to allow a hopper fare or give them a particular sort of pass that lets them use different transit systems and get the task done. Yet that's not being done. That is something extremely basic. Second is, as you mentioned, this idea of not feeling comfortable in, you know, public places, and especially when it comes to areas where it's, you know, away from you, where you have to travel to work and you have to take these public transport systems to go. It's been noted that a majority of women have felt unsafe. They have been harassed in a public transport system, which already dissuades them from using it. But more often than not, when you're dissuaded from using public transport system, it also means that you're wiped out of the formal workforce because you have no means to get to where you work. So that's another thing, that the ways to solve this problem are very easy. Setting up extra lighting, you know, ensuring that in some places, like I think Denmark, where the bus stand always tells you how many minutes away is the next bus, which means that there is lighting and you also know for how long you need to stand in the open, or having good pedestrian walkways in case the distance is less. All of these are very, very simple ways to combat the safety issue. It's also important to ensure last mile delivery, where you can't have bus stations or, you know, train stops being so far away from where people actually live, that is, you know, residential areas, that people have to take multiple systems, because that one increases cost, increases time, but also makes it more likely that women are now susceptible to multiple instances of sexual harassment while making a single journey. So these are just three very simple ideas when it comes to designing a transport system that works for women, so as to ensure not just that women's lives are made easier, so that the time that they get for leisure increases if the time spent on, you know, unpaid care work reduces, but also a way to integrate them back into the workforce, because women's safety is probably one of the largest concerns for why women also don't enter the workforce. And that is one of Perez's big arguments, that the overhauls that she and other women have suggested before this, urban planners have suggested, are not something that required you to completely overthrow the current system, but rather make small tweaks to accommodate women. And the fact that we budge, or we refuse to budge rather, on this issue is probably very telling about the fact that we're refusing to make space for about half of the population to use the very resources that men can use so freely.
Right. Thank you for that, Arushi. Listener, now it's time to take a short break. On the other side, we will discuss a few more specific instances of how data bias affects women disproportionately. Welcome back. You're listening to All Things Policy, and I'm Atish Padhi. We've been discussing Caroline Perez's book, Invisible Women, and how when men are taken as the baseline to design various social systems, it affects women disproportionately. So Arushi, let's get on to technology and how the design of technology has some of these adverse effects that we've been discussing about, right? And you mentioned something really interesting about the iPhone. Do you want to go on with that?
Right. So I think one thing to remember is that the idea that comes out behind this is that men tend to have bigger hands than women on average. So now let's talk about this. Now, often, and something you would have noticed, dear listener, over the last few years, is that our phones have been getting bigger. And now what this has meant is that these phones are too big for an average woman's hands. And now this is not to say that smaller phones don't exist. Of course, the iPhone SE exists. But now the SE wasn't updated for 2 years and was an inferior product when it came to, you know, the rest of the iPhone range. Now, there are countries where you have particular products available for, you know, women with smaller hands. But isn't it unfair that, you know, women have to pay the same price for a product that is of inferior use, or, you know, is going to offer them a lower delivery than men? And it also doesn't make sense given the fact that, at least in Apple's case, women make up most of their buyers. That they are a large part of Apple's customers are women who buy iPhones. And yet Apple is refusing to adopt to their needs, which tells you that even though women are now making up a majority, and the fact that, you know, a company that is making a product should cater to its very customers, it isn't really doing that. Now, that's thoughtful, food for thought, I guess. Second is the idea of safety in cars that comes to seat belts and, you know, airbags. Again, they are tested on a standard male body of 70 kgs and a particular height and weight. Again, not very conducive to women. The kind of force that probably a woman would land on the steering wheel with is far lesser than what a 70 kg man would. And these, you know, safety equipment may not be accounting for that, or at least they didn't for a really long time. But more interestingly and more recently, we're seeing the rise of voice-activated, you know, systems, whether it is to unlock your phone, whether it is to tell Siri to do something. Voice recognition software and voice-based applications are on the rise. Yet, we have to remember that this is artificial intelligence, so the system is only as good as you train it. And, well, they are being trained on largely male voices. There has been this idea that speech recognition technology is trained on large databases called corpora, but corpora is dominated by recordings of male voices. And it's not very difficult to find a database with women voices. For instance, the British National Corpus is supposedly sex balanced. It is only about a company going and making the extra effort to actually include the people that are going to use it. And well, sort of going back to Peterson's argument about, you know, why don't women do this in case they really want to join the workforce? There have been multiple people saying that why don't women speak more clearly? Why don't, you know, women enunciate their vowels a different way so that the voice recognition software understands them? But that's not really the problem, is it? The problem is that you're not training a model with adequate samples of women. So the model doesn't even recognize the voice of a woman at times, let alone understanding her pronunciation. And I think those are interesting ideas that I came across in the book. There's also this idea that any sort of image software is, you know, not trained with enough female pictures either. And you have to remember that this is something that is on the rise today. Tech is taking over the world as we see it. And if we aren't training the systems of the future to still account for more than half of the population, we're probably in for a very bleak future when it comes, because we're not wiping out the already existing data gap. And if the world is becoming more and more based on data, we're only exacerbating the data gap as it exists. But Atish, you had a few examples you wanted to speak of as well.
Yeah. So there was this excellent book I read last year called The Alignment Problem, Machine Learning and Human Values by this computer scientist called Brian Christian, in which his central argument is that often we think technology is going to solve, artificial intelligence especially, is going to solve many of our problems. It will transform the world. But in fact, there is a fundamental error that we commit, which is that often the outcomes that we want or desire from these systems, from these models, and what we train them for are not the same. There is an alignment problem in that. And an amazing example he gives is that around 2018, Reuters reported that starting from 2014, Amazon was trying to train a system that would help them hire more efficiently, right? So it would rate everyone that sends in their CVs, potential candidates, from 1 to 5, so that they could, like, you know, be more efficient, save more time, and hire only people that are, like, you know, high on the priority list, right? And they start doing this, and the way they go about it is that the parameter in which they decide what is the best candidate is how they train the model, is that these people who are applying to the job should be the most similar to the present and past hires of Amazon. So present employees and everyone, you know, else that has worked previously in those specific roles, and their resumes is what the system was trained on, right? So that they believe that, you know, these are the people we have hired in the past. So if the system picks up from there, it will help us hire more people like we already have who are brilliant. The big problem was only a year later, Amazon realized that this system was not selecting any female candidates. Male candidates were getting shortlisted much, much more than the female candidates. And they tried to fix this, right? The names were removed. It was anonymized. Many of the attempts were made to, you know, fix the model. They even removed stuff like, you know, if someone went to a woman's college, right? So that means they are most likely a woman, right? So then they trained the system to, you know, ignore biases like that. Even then, the system continued to pick up only males and not females, or males, overwhelmingly males and not enough females, even if the females were more qualified, right? And the reason was because these AI systems are so powerful and they are designed specifically to find hidden correlations that require a lot of computing power that is beyond our human capacity. They could even find correlation between something as simple or trivial as what adjectives you use. For example, men are more likely to use adjectives such as execute or capture, right? Which are very militaristic and martial. Women are less likely to do that. So even if they remove all other explicitly gender-related variables from the, you know, training data set, the system could still pick up from adjectives like this and still know which one is a male and which one is a female, and then only shortlist the male applicant. And this became so bad that Amazon had to throw away the entire system. They had to stop the project because they realized that it is beyond recovery. So this is just one example of how, you know, we believe that technology in some way will transform our lives, right? And this is a point that is beyond, like, that I'm making, that is, like, beyond the discussion that we're doing right now, which is that technology does not fundamentally really transform much. Often what it does is it amplifies the biases we already have, while also amplifying the abilities we have. So we should not think of technology as something transformative, but only as, like, scaling up of human powers and human biases to a large degree. So yeah, that was an example that I came across that I found very interesting about another way in which women get the, you know, bad end of the deal for no fault of their own. So yeah, Arushi, moving on next to health, right? And I think this is probably the most important part of our discussion. So do you want to talk about what Perez talks about with relation to this, and then we can go into COVID and wrap up?
Right. So I think I want to start with the chapter where he aptly is titled Being Worth Less Than a Shoe. It tells a story about an immigrant worker at, you know, a nail salon who's, and the reason it's called this is the chapter is named this is because it's the story of an immigrant worker at a nail salon who is fired because she spills chemical on the shoes of a very rich customer. And, well, her life, and one forgets that, you know, the chemical that she spills, that she's been being exposed to every single day, is something that is very harmful to her health. And this goes back to the story of BPA, or bisphenol A. It was in 2008 that people finally, you know, started realizing that this is a very toxic chemical, that one shouldn't be exposed to it. But it's been so ubiquitous that it's been detected in the urine of 93% of Americans over the age of 6. After this finding in 2008, a U.S. federal agency came out and said that this compound that we were interacting with on a daily basis may cause cancer. But this is something that could have been avoided. We didn't have to wait until 2008 to find out that BPA was problematic. BPA can mimic female hormone estrogen since, you know, we've known this since the mid-1930s. And since at least the 1970s, we have known that synthetic estrogen can be carcinogenic in women. And it was in 1971 that, and the reason for this is because in 1971, another synthetic estrogen that was being prescribed to women, pregnant women for the last 30 years was banned following the fact that it led to rare vaginal cancers in young women who were exposed to this when they were in the womb of their mothers. Now, and this, and therefore, this idea of, you know, if you had just considered the fact that it does, it is impacting people who are being exposed to this on a daily basis, we could have avoided waiting an additional almost 40 years to come up with a ruling that said that we must be careful of BPA. Similarly, when we look at softwares, going back a little bit to the tech side of things, when we look at softwares that are trained to, you know, find out the disease that a person has, more often than not, a woman with symptoms of vomiting and stomachache, etc., the first question you're asked is, or the first, you know, response that's thrown up at you is that, are you pregnant? It is beyond the imagination of even the best trained of softwares to imagine that you could have a condition other than pregnancy. The author actually makes a mention of this in the book where she talks about a particular person who had to wait 12 years to be diagnosed with colon problems, that because she'd been left undiagnosed for so long, she became more susceptible to colon cancer. The bias exists in healthcare, especially when women go to doctors, but also within the tech that is now emerging as the new solution to having to go to a doctor. There is no difference between the online and the offline for women. While the offline relies on a person's biases, the online is relying on the biases of the data that exists. And as we've been speaking about for the last 35 minutes, this bias is very large. This bias is more likely to represent only a half truth at best, or maybe not the truth at all for women. And in conditions of healthcare, this becomes really, really important, because when conditions go untreated, we know that it's not a good thing, especially if it's a chronic illness. But the fact that we are refusing to take half of our population seriously when they come in with symptoms, that we just prescribe them a painkiller like ibuprofen or an aspirin because, well, it's just something to do with their menstrual cycle. We're just reducing them to that. We aren't seeing them as a whole human being who is susceptible to a whole range of diseases. And in that process, we're making them far more vulnerable to things that are not curable, like cancer. But those are, you know, the problems that exist with the current system. But Atish, right now we're going through a public health crisis. I think I read an article in the New York Times that said that in India, more pregnant women die than any other, you know, demographic in India. So what, according to you, what role, according to you, does this data bias or this gender bias in data play when it comes to the pandemic and maybe specifically in the case of India?
Yeah, with regards to COVID also, the consequences have been deeply gendered. And here I would like to reference this great article that one of our colleagues, Mahek Nankani, wrote in news18.com. And there she makes some very good arguments about the gendered effects of COVID. Now she cites a study by Alex Sanyan and Weinman titled Women, Men and COVID-19, which investigates the effect of COVID-19 pandemic on gender-based health disparities, right? So they take data from 133 countries, and that suggested that around 14% of the countries reported that over 65% of their COVID-19 cases and deaths were just men, right? So countries like Bahrain and Qatar, for example, reported that over 80% of the confirmed cases were men, and over 75% of total COVID deaths in countries like Chad, Bangladesh, Malawi, and Pakistan were men. Now, from what we know of existing research from COVID, this seems quite clearly the result of bias. It's not like men are way more likely than women to catch COVID, right? This just shows that, in fact, of all the excess deaths, all the missing data we have on COVID from across the world, much of it is likely to be women, especially in the global south, especially in countries like India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, Middle Eastern nations, right? And this has very deep implications on the health of women, because as Arushi already said, right, and Meg also makes this argument that research has shown that the symptoms of many, many rather common diseases or events like heart attack are different in women than they are in men. And when the baseline is that of a man, this means that women often get misdiagnosed. With COVID specifically, of course, we do not know exactly how many more women have died from COVID than we are actually aware of, and how COVID has affected them in many other ways. For example, when in India we think about a farmer, right, we often think of a man. But in fact, most of agricultural labor in India is done by women. And during when the pandemic set in India, and this is not directly a health effect, but it is a related effect, where after the pandemic occurred and we announced a lockdown, migrant workers had to go back home, right? And a lot of these women were now confined back to their houses because the men returned, and they started working, or women continued to work, were forced to work, and they had more mouths to feed because the men were unemployed. And this has effects on their health as well. We saw that domestic violence increases when unemployment increases, right? We know that even things like a bad cricket match or a bad football match, for example, in the recent 2021 Euros, after England lost the final thanks to penalty shootouts, where three black players missed the penalty. Of course, racial violence against black people in the UK went up, but also domestic violence against women shot up massively because men, who are often the largest section of people watching and following football and cricket and all of the sports much more closely, get very upset and then start beating the wives or girlfriends or even like siblings, mothers. So we just know that there are many of these effects that might not directly be health effects themselves, but have very damaging physical and mental emotional consequences, which are also thereby, you know, effects of that, which can be counted as health effects. So yeah, that's what I wanted to add. And there are many of these things that, as a man, for example, I would miss. That's why I have been citing so many books, because none of this comes quite intuitively to me unless like I read some excellent work which throws light to stuff like this. And finally, I just wanted to, like, before, you know, I hand it back to you, Arushi, another book that I remembered which had a very good point about this is this book called How Not to Be Wrong by Jordan Ellenberg, which is about statistics and how to use math in public communication so that you are not dumb, right? And there he cites a data point to make an argument about how in the 2008 global financial crisis, if you look at the data, all the jobs that men lost, they eventually got back by 2009-10. women did not. It took women, I think, 5, 6, 7 years for them for female employment in United States and EU to go back to pre-2008 levels. So even the greed of banks, even the greed of, you know, the global financial system also inadvertently affects women, and they end up losing employment and then not hired back, right? So yeah, I think that's all I had. Arushi, do you want to add something else?
I think just like the last closing point, this, as I began the podcast by quoting from the book, I think at the end, you know, that was my last point by quoting from the book as well. There is the solution to sex and gender data gap is quite clear. We have to close the female representation gap. When women are involved in decision-making, in research, in knowledge production, women do not get forgotten. Female lives and perspectives are brought out of the shadows, and this is to the benefit of women everywhere, and often, consequently, benefit of humanity as a whole. And so to return to Freud's riddle of femininity, it turns out that the answer was staring us in the face all along. All we really needed to do was ask women. And I think that's the entire idea that Perez highlights with the book, that it's about time that we stop letting the stories of women be relegated to shadows, that we stop making excuses for not collecting data on women, and we close the gender data gap that exists right now before it gets much worse as we propel towards a world that is going to be driven solely and solely by data.
Thank you so much. That was excellent, Arushi. Thank you so much for joining us, listener. I hope this conversation was as enlightening to you as it was to me. We will see you next time. Bye.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week, Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank, and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.